tonight on Arena. Jackal performs live in studio, and Jimmy McAlevey on his new play about a US astronaut chatting with a lonely Donegal ham radio enthusiast. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. He's been gigging and performing for a couple of decades, I think it's safe to say, at this stage in time. Always with a legion of superfans in his midst. And that amazing voice of his. I am delighted that the one and only Jack L, also known as Jack Lukeman, is with me in studio this evening. Jack is about to play at the Hinterland Festival in Kells, County Meath, and has a show in October featuring the songs of Jacques Brel. And that's where I want to start, with the songs of Jacques Brel. Jack will now perform If Only We Had Love.
If we only have love, then tomorrow will dawn, and the days of our years will rise on that morn. If we only have love, we could melt all the guns and then give the new world to our daughters and our sons. If we only have love, then paradise stands. And then death has no shadow. There are no foreign lands. If we only have love, we will never bow down. We'll be tall as the pines. Neither heroes nor clowns. If we only have love, then we'll only be human, and we'll drink from the grail to be born once again. Time, oh, space, the sun and the stars. If we only have love.
If we only have love, a song by Jacques Brel, sung for us live this evening on Arena by Jack L, Jack Lukeman. We could melt all the guns and give the world to our daughters and sons.
It's what? One of the, it's just one of the, I mean, that's an abbreviated version. It's a shorter version. It's just got, I mean, it's up there with All You Need Is Love as the great song about, you know, peace and love. And
what a song to sing after a news bulletin at any point in the last couple of years.
That's why I'm so happy to go back and sing these songs and perform them and just let people hear them, because they're old songs. I think that was his first single, obviously originally in French, but the translations are magnificent and as poignant as they ever were.
Well, it's just when you sang that line, the simplicity of it and the depth of it really jumped out at me. Brel, obviously a huge influence on you and on your your own songwriting.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
I would argue even in on your delivery, Jack.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I suppose it was a strange coincidence, not only my name being Jack Lukeman, Jack L, Jack Brel. That was just a coincidence. And the theatrical nature of his songs. I mean, I came to I was doing my own stuff early in the 90s, recording that. And then I got in with a band called the Black Romantics, and we were all Scott Walker fans, which is how we all got into Brel. And we decided we would do a show of Jacques Brel's songs, which went on to become a big kind of hit, playing in a place in the Dark Club in Dublin, going on at 12 o'clock at night to toll the bell, and it was wild stuff. And that went on, and we used to do Midnight at the Olympia and everything. And but it was great to bring those songs to people again. And, they've always felt, they're old, wise songs. So maybe I'm finally at the age where I'm old enough to sing them almost,
and I suppose coming back to them is interesting. I'm looking at the text here, and funnily enough, I was curious, not exactly in the way this listener was. Call this listener 691. When they don't give their name, I give the last three numbers of their phone. So listener 691 is curious, what make of guitar is Jack playing? Because I looked over, I thought, is he playing a 12-string guitar? Because there's so much sound coming from it. Well, it's an 8-string, 6-string guitar.
It's a 6-string guitar. It's a Fate guitar. I'm pretty sure it's an Irish kind of a make. Fate, they're called. They're very good. I use a lot of special effects as well. I like my old production, and I like playing with sound and making things, sound different than they usually do.
However, you can't play with sound to do what you did with the word stars in the final verse that you sang there of Jacques Brel. I don't know how long that stars note lasted for, but that voice of yours, it's over the years, I mean, I've been listening to you for years now. Thanks. I don't know how many decades. Let's not go there for both our sakes. But the quality of your voice, it hasn't faltered. And I was looking at the ease with which you seem to deliver. You don't force it. Have you never abused the voice? Have you always been careful about that?
No, I would say I haven't. I've been pretty bad to my voice over the years. I would
don't do night
after, after night and stuff like that. But essentially, if you just don't talk a lot, don't over talk, and just drink a lot of water and sleep, that those kind of on rock and roll things are the things. But I just got lucky, with a voice, and it's kind of developed over the years. Maybe the bottom end of it has come out a little bit more. Not that I lost anything on the top, but it's kind of so it's a very, very interesting journey as a singer, just growing up and growing old with your voice. When you listen to Sinatra and you listen to him when he was younger, he had the higher tone, and then he was like an old oak tree as he got older. I don't know. So it's a very interesting journey. Yeah.
Robert in Galway is prepared to identify himself as caller 691. Thank you, Robert in Galway, for that. That's Robert was asking about the guitar. I also ask about the voice because it makes me think of the kind of musical household that you grew up in. I know there was a mechanical background. Your great grandfather, I think, was it?
Yeah, started? I think he won the ploughing championship back in the early 1900s. He was the first man to drive a tractor in Ireland. They called him. He was the guy who knew all about machinery and. Mm. So then my grandfather went on to start a business, which my father and his two brothers carried on to. My brother carries on to this day. So, it was a big house, lots of people coming and going all the time, lots of family around, and always great sing songs when at Christmas and
what
stuff.
What kind of music was there? Every kind, I'm guessing.
Well, my dad was into Sinatra and Mario Lanza and all those big old tunes. So he would have sang then, and my brother would have been to trad stuff. So a little bit of everything, we would have given everything a blast. But it was kind of the first time, I suppose, I realised that my voice, had an effect on people, and people were impressed by it, and I suppose it gave me a little bit of confidence. And then I always had several octaves once my voice broke. So it was always fun to sing, just for me to sing. I left school early, and I did like 3 years as a mechanic in the family business. I don't think everybody knew I wasn't going to be a mechanic, because I was always just obsessed with music and anything musical, and I would stay in the garage in the evenings and sing with the great big reverb and echo, which was always a great
spot to check your voice out.
I keep saying I'm going to do a live stream from the old garage and listen to that sound again.
And you very kindly sent us in a recording. This is just beyond beautiful. This happened. Will we listen first, maybe? And I'll explain that this is Jack's dad. That's what I will say. And it's related to the lockdown period. But, and I presume it's you on the guitar here.
It is, yeah.
So Jack on the guitar and his dad, Sean Sr., on vocals here.
Fairy tales can come true, it can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day, and love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart? For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part, have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
The guitar playing there of Jack Lukeman and the voice of Sean Lukeman, Sean Senior, as you refer, he died a couple of years back. Where was that recording from?
That was from a studio at home. I had him out there one day, and it was actually, you know, he had had a stroke about 2 years before he died. So, but I had got him just in his late 70s, and I had recorded him doing that, and then. That was one take, you know, just no problem. It was just a natural, no inhibition, just the way he went and sang it, like, you know, and it was just a very natural singer. And then during the lockdown, I did a lockdown album, so it was a great chance for us to do all those things we always meant to do. So at 80, I think it was 80, 81, he released his first record, and thank you for playing that, and it's been played on RT before, so it's just such, it's very hard for me to listen to. But
I can imagine that, and I'm sure, particularly in and around the time after he passed away, that, you know, to listen to that. But it's such a beautiful thing that now, I guess, as time goes on. And your mother, I hope, is listening tonight.
Yes, Rose. She is, of course. Yeah, my mother, Rose, she'll be listening. And proud of that.
I hope that will have made her proud too. Lots of texts coming in here. Brona, I saw Jack in Bray last year, and in Athy with Donacha, my son, in Whelan's. Love him, and Scott. Donacha and I loved him dancing on the table in Whelan's. Was that during the gig or after the gig, Jack?
I've been known to dance on the table too during the gig. You know, that whole thing started one night. I was actually remember playing in Whelan's, and the PA system kept breaking down. Not that it does that in Whelan's regularly, but it just, whatever night was in it. So I ended up walking out onto the tables and just singing a song a cappella. And afterwards, it was all anybody would talk about. Meanwhile, we had the pyrotechnics going on and everything, all this rehearsal done. So I've always kind of kept that in the show, where I'll break down everything and just do a song without any, because that's how I started singing. That's how I always heard my dad singing, you know. So just
with no accompaniment, just
the voice.
You used to sing Chocolate Eyes for my son every night when he was a baby. One of my favourite songs ever. Jack is a legend, says Kieran in Limerick. And well, Jack L obviously didn't lick the talent off the stones. Beautiful voice by Sean Senior. I'm not bawling at all. I think that's a small lie from Gillian in Tralee. simply glorious. I was kind of surprised to read you're a big fan of Vaughan Williams, the English composer.
Yeah, he'd probably been my favourite, I'd have to say.
What is it about his music that attracts you, Jack?
I don't know. The Lark Ascending, it speaks to me just as a singer as much as anything else. Mm. You know, I love even his version of Greensleeve, stuff like that. He just had a way with his movement of strings, very cinematic for a time when they didn't really have cinema.
Yeah. There.
But I'm also a big fan of, you know, Ennio Morricone, John Barry, all film soundtracks, and it's a place I'm very interested in. So I think they would have all taken a lot from Vaughan Williams too.
And would you say that in terms of your own compositional process, do you think that those film and classical composers, do they feed in any way? I mean, there's a classic nature to your voice and to that production.
Yeah, no, most definitely, yeah. And I definitely would fall into that category, I suppose. And I've done a lot of stuff with orchestras, and my voice sits in well with, I've been lucky enough to sing with the Brooklyn Philharmonic Orchestra or the Nelson Riddle Orchestra in the States, and all the various wonderful orchestras we have.
Yeah, the RT
in
RT Orchestra
and around
Orchestra,
the
yeah,
country. And
Symphony Orchestra, yeah.
So, yeah, I would definitely, I mean, I'm kind of working on a folk album with an orchestra is what I'm working towards at the moment.
Oh, the Vaughan Williams touch will certainly feed into that, I would have thought. Now, you're coming back to the Brel songs for the show in the Olympia, which will be in October, so I'm guessing that's a bit far off at the moment. I don't know if you're dug into the centre of them or not. But the show that you're doing at Hinterland in Kells coming up towards the end of the month, is that kind of are you looking at everything over the last, is it 30 years?
Yeah, currently. Last year I was touring an album called Broken Songs, which was an album that was 20 years old that I went back to, which had songs like Open Your Borders and Chocolate Eyes on it, actually. But so at the moment, it's so nice to have. I remember starting out and having one album and thinking, oh God, I can't wait till I have two albums. Now I've got about 14 albums of various things. So it's so great to be able to dig in and dig out songs like the Brel songs that I haven't done in years, or a Randy Newman song, or some of my older Records Universe, or like one I'm going to do for Metropolis Blue. So it's just it's a treasure to have a lot of different songs to choose from, I have to say. And in Kells, I'll be digging into that again and bringing the best of what I have, myself and the band.
I was going to ask, is it you and the guitar, or you and the band?
It's myself and the band, yeah. We'll be, songs from the various albums down through the years. I mean, I don't, for someone who's never been to one of my shows, it's very interactive. I'm out in the audience, you know, walking around, getting people to sing along. I know that can be intimidating, but it's not. It's the whole idea is that we all turn into a ball of music together and transcend, and we all go home and we all forget all the mess that's going on at the moment, and music takes us away like music is meant to do, the great thing that transcends.
Have you explained to the stage managers and the stage people in Kells that you want a line of tables so that you can dance down the middle of the audience?
I will be dancing on tables. Hopefully we all will be, yes.
Okay. Health and safety will be happy to hear that's happening. Maybe tell us a little bit about When the Moon is High before you sing it for us.
Well, this is a little tune from my first solo album. It was called Metropolis Blue, and this was the opening track on it, which goes something like this. I thought I'd do one for the summer. It's these little things make this life so beautiful, so glorious, so divine, like a summer breeze on a warm July night. Makes me want to kiss the stars as they shine in your. When the moon is high and I am half asleep, I dream on, I pretend you are close, close to me. Day after day, week after week,
It's these little things make this life so beautiful, so glorious, so divine, like a summer breeze on a warm July night. Makes me wanna kiss the stars as they shine in your smile. There was a time long, long, long ago, you were the queen of the Nile. I was your young pharaoh. Oh, it's these little things make this life so beautiful, so glorious, summer breeze on a warm July night. Makes me wanna kiss, makes me wanna kiss the
special effects thrown in just at the end there, and Jack Al having a great big smile for himself at that. Beautiful stuff indeed. And you have flavour just to some of the texts, Jack, that are coming in. I've been a Jack Al fan for a very long time, always will be. He never fails to deliver for his fans, says Louis Gahan. I'm hoping I'm saying Lucy's name right there. Hi, Jack, from Mary Cullen. Been following Jack for a good many years now. He's just amazing and so lovely to his fans. So there you go. And lovely, lovely one here. Thanks, from Joe Lynham in Mullingar, picking up on the song from With Your Dad. Just so moving, that from Jack and his dad. And so it was. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Jack. Thanks a million.
Jack Lukeman will be performing at the Hinterland Festival in Kells. Runs from the 26th through to the 29th of June. Martin Sixsmith, John Banville, John Boyne, Laura Marler, Kevin Barry, Roisin O'Donnell, Brian Dobson and the ever-excellent John Creedon will all be there, and a few others besides, I would say. And for more details on that, the website is hinterland.ie, and you can see Jack L's Jack Brell Show at the Olympic Theatre on October the 11th. A veteran astronaut returning from space and a lonely radio operator in Donegal find themselves on a collision course in a new play by Jimmy McAlevey. The play is called Static. It takes to the Peacock Stage in the Abbey Theatre, of the Abbey Theatre, this Friday evening. I'm delighted that Jimmy McAlevey is with me in studio this evening. It's the most unusual encounter. We've a ham, a radio ham up in Donegal, yeah, lonely by himself, and a fella up in space coming home lonely and by himself. Now, we'll get to what you do in your play in a minute.
Okay.
But this actually has a very strong basis in truth.
Well, it did happen. And it has been coming back to me how I remember it. It's a wee bit cloudy because it was back in 1991.
Hmm.
And I was on holiday with Eugene McKenna, fishing in inverted commas. And we were fishing one day in this pub called Fearix. And we had invented a drink which we called the Fearic, which was a pinty Guinness with the brandy in it and the brandy on the side.
A very little fishing done, I would say, before or after that. Yeah.
But it was in the pub across the road from there, Burke's in Clonbur, and I picked up the paper and I read a little article, I think it was the Irish Times, about how this guy in Donegal had got in touch with a lone cosmonaut orbiting Earth in the Mir space station. Now, at the time, this was miraculous because pre-internet, pre-mobile phones, and I was amazed by this. I promptly forgot about it. But, I mean, the true story, communism collapsed while this cosmonaut was up there. And, of course, they didn't tell him. And it was up to the guy in Donegal, Manus Joe McClafferty, to tell him, you know, the way you're a hero of the revolution, well, now you're a schmuck.
And did he put it in such lovely Donegal no, language?
No, by all accounts, he was a really lovely man.
Mm.
And my ham radio enthusiast is a bit different.
Yeah. And Sergei Kirkilev was the Soviet cosmonaut.
That's correct. Yeah,
referred to sometimes as the last Soviet citizen because of what you're saying, what was happening in history.
Yeah, and then, I mean, there was an international story that his craft was breaking down. And they didn't know what to do and whether he would or not he would die. Of course, he didn't know that.
Nobody was telling him that
Nobody
either.
Was telling him. So it was down to your man in Donegal to tell him.
Jeepers.
Yeah.
But did he make it home?
He did make it home, There was a rescue mission, which I think was internationally funded.
All right.
So
that was the kind of that was the real story that you came across in 1991. Yeah. So it's a while back from that story. When did you start then adapt or working it into the play that you have here, which is this man in Donegal, lonely for all sorts of reasons that we don't have to go into all of them.
Okay.
And then this US astronaut who's on his final flight.
Yes, yes.
Final space flight.
Well, I didn't want to get into the whole fall of communist Russia thing. That's a play in itself, or a series of plays. And I had found myself getting very interested in retirement. Not that, I mean, I'm years away from retirement and it'll retire from me before I retire from it.
From writing.
But I see a lot of men retiring and it's a calamity. You know, they feel rejected by the world. They've invested so much meaning and purpose
in their job.
In their job, yeah. And often with very tragic consequences. But their wives go wild swimming and have mystical experiences and then meet their friends for lunch and white wine and plan their next city break. You know, it seems a peculiarly male experience to me. I also write about women, but this one's about men.
And given what you're saying there, you know, that it is can be a calamitous experience for men, what advice, you're miles from it, but what are you doing to prepare for that miles away event, or what are you thinking about how to prepare for retirement?
God, I don't know. I dread it. The darkness closing in, the void opening up, you know that way, Sean?
Don't now. Don't pull me down too low of a Tuesday night. But, you know, you're a writer.
Yeah.
So you're used to getting up and facing the void on a daily basis, albeit a white void of the empty page or the empty screen in front of you if you're typing away on a computer. Has that given you any? How do you face that on a daily basis when you're actually working?
Well, I lead a very similar life to the guy in Donegal. I have an isolating job.
Hmm.
And I remember Martin Amis saying, if you wanted to be a writer, you'd want to be happy with wandering about in your dressing gown all day, you know.
Anything wrong with that?
Yeah, well, I didn't really expect that. I didn't really anticipate that, you know.
When you're in the writing mode, are you very isolated? Does the outside world stay very outside what you're doing?
Well, I can see it, the mud and the cold. and there's a crack in the window that I should get fixed. Yeah, it's a peculiar experience, and like simultaneously, while you're on your own, you're reaching out.
Mm.
You're always reaching out.
Well, it's all about, I presume, the writing. You're not just writing it for yourself. You want it to get to either, if it's a play, you want it to get to the stage. If it's a piece of prose, you want it to get into the book to be read by a reader. Take us into then the kind of dynamic that exists between the two characters in the mm-hmm. play, are called Spaceman and Moonman.
Yeah.
And Moonman, is that a reference to the kind of the handle, as they would say, that the ham operators often have?
That's his CB handle. Yeah. It's also something that he can hide behind to an extent, the way we do when we're communicating in various formats and technologies. He's also a bit of a lunatic. And they have...
Played by Dan Gordon, we should say, in the play.
Played by Dan, and Dan is wonderful. I mean, he just looks at him, looks like him, big face on him. And Dan, as you know, is a big deal in the North. We were lucky to get him.
Yeah, I was watching him recently in Blue Lights. I was watching season two of that.
Blue Lights, yeah.
He plays the dad in that. Or granddad, actually, he plays in that. He's great in that TV series.
But, you know, the play is about, I suppose, the movement of the play is about getting past those handles.
Mm.
And in fact, they don't introduce each other's names until the end.
The conversation starts up. I mean, I don't think I'm giving too much away to say that Spaceman ends up in real trouble because he thinks, I'm not going to make it back. Don't have enough oxygen.
Yeah.
Won't have enough fuel.
Yeah.
You know, I need somebody to let people down there know.
Yes.
So his situation is quite urgent.
Yes. I think for both of them, the situation is urgent, although it only becomes clear later in the play that they're both kind of suspended over their own voids and both in a dark and dangerous place, as your producer Sheila said.
Yeah, because the other side of it is that he is actually Moon Man. There's stuff happening on Earth and at home with him, which is putting him into a very difficult situation, and I'm being careful not to give anything away on that front. But how do these two men, you know, I suppose the cliche is that men don't necessarily open up to each other, that men don't necessarily talk to each other. Is there something about the invisibility, perhaps, of a ham radio operator in Donegal and a fella in a spaceship up in space? They don't have to look each other in the eye as they speak to each other.
There's something about radio, and there's something about the original idea that made me think, despite the fact that the distance is vast and possibly the distance couldn't be any greater, there's something tremendously intimate about radio communication. Hmm. Now, whether that's radio broadcast, listening to the radio, or talking on a CB radio or a ham radio setup, there's just inevitably, after a while, there's nowhere to hide. And after a while in the play, there's nowhere for either of them to hide. And the stakes are high for both.
For both of them, yeah. Emotionally, I suppose you could put it emotionally for Moon Man on Earth, the radio ham operator.
Yeah.
But, you know, simple survival for a spaceman. That you know, he needs to know that somebody out there knows that he's in trouble because he's lost all comms or communication, as he puts it.
That's right. I mean, people have said that the plague takes them somewhere unexpected. Beyond that,
yeah, Sean Mahan, I should say, plays the part of Spaceman
very, very convincingly. I mean, he looks like an astronaut. He's beautiful for a start,
big, handsome devil, is he?
Yeah, and slim and tall, but also is writhing in various agonies. He's great.
I'm wondering too about. I mean, you mentioned there that when the real story took place, or the true story that inspired things, took place back in 1991, space travel was a different thing. It's had a kind of still had an exoticism about it. We were past the Apollo missions, but we were in a very space travel of any kind was quite exciting. Do we take it a bit more for? almost for granted in 2025. Sure, if you've enough money and you're a big enough star, you can go up to space now.
Well, that's true of the present moment. And the kind of moment that the play is set, which is a bit really before now, not hugely, but a bit before now, I think.
Mm.
There's a line in it where the astronaut is saying he met a woman in a bar and she asked him what he did. And he said, I'm an astronaut. And she said, oh, are they still doing that? I mean, there was a period when it was over. When all those ambitions had been junked.
Mm.
And now we're into the period, really, of commercialization of space. We're in the period where space becomes a defense realm. And the play is about that, too.
Yeah, the darkness of the possibilities of what space exploration and space war, I suppose, could bring, or space safety, in fact, could bring us to. It also struck me that here you have these two men, who, and I presume in the stage situation, they can't look at each other either. But what is it about the Peacock Theatre? It strikes me as the intimacy of that particular space would suit this particular type of play.
Yeah, it's perfect for this play. The intimacy, as you say. Also, there's an opportunity, I think, for the director, the designer, the lighting designer and the sound designer to take it over.
Mm.
In fact, I think, if I'm not giving this away too much, that they can put us in perfect darkness, which is a very, very powerful dramatic tool.
Which is, of course, what space is.
Yeah.
Totally and absolutely, totally and absolutely dark. And I suppose getting to have your play on the Peacock stage of the Abbey of the National Theatre, that must be quite a treat.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's been a while, you know, and it feels like I'm putting the green jersey on again. It's very, very gratifying. Yeah.
So are you in preview at the moment? Or with the
previews start on Friday.
Yeah.
We've got previews on Friday, Saturday, we're off on Sunday, Monday and Tuesday. And then the opening night is the 25th. But the play runs until July 18th.
Right through until July 18th. One thing just before I finish up, I meant to ask you when we were talking about the male nature of the play itself.
Mm.
Is there any kind of female energy within the piece, and how important is, how do you fit that into the overall telling of the story?
The clues are there. These men were formed by women. There are three very powerful female presences just off stage, one in particular, who offers a challenge to the astronaut that he tries to meet. That's about all I can say.
Yeah, I know you can't go too far down those particular parts of the story because you will simply give too much away. Thanks so much for coming into us this evening, Jimmy. That's Jimmy McAlevey. And Static, Jimmy's play, is on the Peacock stage of the Abbey from this Friday, the 20th of June, as Jimmy told us, through until the 18th of July. Spaceman played by Sean Mahan. Moonman played by Dan Gordon. John King directs, and you'll find out full details on abbeytheatre.ie. Well, you really were taken by Jack L. earlier on. Still text coming in. Tom, I think it's, or is it Oliver? I'm not sure which name to give as the sender of this text. What an unbelievable performer. Had the pleasure to see wonderful artists like Stevie Wonder, David Bowie and many, many others. But Jack is the best live performer there is. It's signed Oliver, but the message up at the top says Tom. So whichever you are, Tom or Oliver, thank you for that. Now, the boffins among us might know what a Mobius strip is, a long rectangle given a twist and joined together to form a surface with no beginning or ending. And it is very much seen as emblematic of how we experience time in a non-linear way. The Mobius book from Catherine Lacey can be read from either end. There's a memoir and a fiction reflecting on each other in theme and content and meeting each other in the middle of the book. Sounds mind-bending? Well, yes, to a certain extent. But this, I think Catherine Lacey might argue, is how we experience the world. Plotlessness, no neat endings, no neat beginnings, no resolution, just an ongoing Mobius strip. And I'm delighted to have Catherine Lacey join me live from New York this evening. It does sound like a pretty awful place to be in the middle of this Mobius strip with no resolution to anything, Catherine, and with difficulties all around us. Is that how you see things?
I mean, it's hard not to. And I mean, also just thanks for having me on. It's delightful to talk to you. And thank you for giving this book a little bit of space. It is, I really liked your take on it, that it is kind of, I hadn't thought so much of the way that the Mobius sort of applies to the whole concept of memoir, which as a novelist, I kind of, I'm an avid memoir reader, but I think when I approached actually writing one, it sort of immediately presented narrative problems to me, because I know that the way that I experience my life is not the same way that I experience novels or experience writing novels.
Yeah, and I mean, you're hardly one now to give us plot point A followed by plot point B followed by plot point C and so on through the so on through the alphabet. You've always been, I think it's fair to say, in your previous fiction, works of fiction, you haven't followed that linear way. Why then were you so afraid, maybe isn't quite the right word, dubious or hesitant to approach memoir, the nonfiction form?
I guess there's a bunch of reasons. I mean, part of it is just I've gotten quite comfortable with writing fictional characters and sort of following the logic of a story. And for me, often that's, you know, things happen out of order, or maybe the narratives don't follow the exact sort of conventional sequence. And yeah, I had gotten pretty comfortable in there. It didn't seem, it just seemed like it was just in a place of comfort. And I think I just had a couple of experiences that sort of made my life seem kind of like a work of fiction for really about a year. And I think that was sort of what pushed me into writing it. And I did so sort of hesitantly, because I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to publish it, for myself, just like emotionally.
Yeah, because I mean, it deals the memoir section part, and I don't know whether to say it's first or second, that part of the book, the memoir, depending on where you choose to start. You know, the book is kind of one cover, in the version I have it anyway, is black with white writing on it. The other one is white with black writing on it. They meet each other upside down, and you just, whatever way the book was handed to me, I started with the memoir section. That just happened to be the way it was handed to me. I think it would be handed to me the other way around. I might have started the other way around. But the memoir does detail, to say the very least, a difficult time in your life quite recently.
Yes, quite recently, but also like my childhood religious experiences that I had never really had a way to come to understand. I had tried to write about kind of losing an extreme relationship to Christianity that I had as a child and into my teenage years, and the kind of 5-year process of losing that. And it had never really made any sense to me about that loss of faith had never really made any sense to me, partially because the faith itself had been kind of opaque and I had a difficult time understanding it. And it was really kind of the aftermath of a very sudden and strange breakup from the end of a very complicated and strange relationship that sort of threw me back into, I don't know, a different sort of awareness of what faith is in general.
Well, you seem to make or draw parallels, I think, in the book between this idea of religious faith and the kind of trust that you must put in having religious faith, and the kind of trust that you must put in as this was a romantic relationship.
Exactly. I mean, I think there is something, you know, I think there's sort of this line between, you know, people of faith or people that are even agnostic and maybe still open to some kind of faith in the divine, and then people that are staunch atheists and say, well, because this thing can't be proved and because these things are used to control people and blah, blah, blah. And if you can only put your faith in things that can be scientifically proven. But if you really believe that, you kind of throw out the possibility of romantic love, of even platonic love, of all kinds of trusting the emotions and emotional lives of other people. And I think it was kind of realizing that comparison that has pushed me into a place of, I think faith is much bigger than we give it credit for. And I think when I think about faith, I think about all types of faith, not just religious faith. And I think, I don't know, maybe that could be a way for, you know, people that are not religious and people that are to kind of come to understand each other a little bit more.
That sounds as if, you know, you detail in the memoir section of the book that experience you had as a teenager, the loss of faith, the loss of appetite. You lost a lot of weight. There was a lot of difficulties around your life at that particular time. But it sounds from what you've just said as if there has been a reawakening of your faith in some ways in recent times.
Yeah, I don't know if I quite can put my finger on it. Certainly, it's nowhere near the type of faith that I had as a child, only because at that time, you know, in my childhood and adolescence and into even young adulthood, I was dealing with and reacting to and trying to orient myself around the idea of heaven and hell and the Christian God and a very kind of, and actually kind of very absolute black and white sense of what the divine could be. And I definitely have had experiences in the last few years that have raised more questions than answers, I would say, and like put me in a place of, I wouldn't say being open to necessarily organized religion, but actually just being more curious about what we can't prove in this life, maybe what can't be completely verifiable, but perhaps what can be sensed in one way or another, and giving space to that, even if it can't be scientifically exactly studied.
And has that made you think more further at this point in time about the afterlife and what might be or might not be there?
Oh, I don't. I mean, the afterlife, I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, I think I don't. There's some kind of, I feel like it used to really trouble me, and I'm sure at different times in my life perhaps it will trouble me more, but right now I think the sense of what happens after you die is just, well, we go back to where we were before we were born. I don't remember any pain of not existing before I was born, and so I think it stands to reason that I won't experience any pain of not existing after I'm dead. But I don't know.
That's very Mobius. That's very Mobius. That's very Mobius strip, isn't it? That, you know, that the afterlife and the before life, same spot. However, I did want to touch on the elements of the. I mean, there's an extraordinary section where you're dealing with this split, the breakup of this relationship, which was communicated to you by email from the next room, type of thing, in the house you were living in at the time. I mean, breaking up by text is one thing. An email from next door.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking. I mean, it was, you know, a 6-year relationship at that point, and I lived with him and his mother in a house that we had bought so we could all live together. And, you know, I think when you buy a house, you're kind of thinking, oh, 30-year mortgage. Like, I don't know, I felt pretty comfortable with a sense of a sort of ongoing present. And there had been no discussion of us breaking up. So it was pretty shocking, and I would say like a complete loss of faith. I mean, that said, it means a pretty extreme and kind of hilarious to me now way to break up with somebody. But, you know, I think people go through these kinds of things all the time. I'm not presenting my story as something that's like uniquely mine. I think like there'll probably be something in your life, if there hasn't already been, that's just as out of nowhere, you know.
No, my life is perfect. I'm happy to report, I wish. At any rate, the other thing I noticed about, and we don't need to go into the personalities involved here, those who know you will know some of your past history and they can enjoy that whatever way or not enjoy it as they so wish. But you refer to the person from whom you broke up or who sent you the email as the reason. And I kept asking myself, the reason for what?
Well, that really comes from that very first chapter that was just, you know, I was in the guest room in my house, sleeping in the guest room in my house, which was not a place I had ever slept before. And, it's the third sentence or something in the book, the reason that I'm in the guest room is the man downstairs, you know? And so that I think I wrote that in my notebook. I just started calling him the reason in my notebook because I just didn't even want to write his name down. And so then it carried into the book itself.
Now, I do want to touch, and I don't want to get into the ins and outs of the fictional part of the book then, but very much the characters in the fictional part of the book, two women essentially who know each other via a mutual acquaintances. Let's just put it like that. But what struck me here was the fictional part of the book, while you were dealing with romantic love and romantic relationships and faith relationships in many ways in the memoir, friendship, straightforward, if such a thing exists, friendship seemed to be at the heart of the fiction.
Oh, it's at the heart of everything, whether I realized it or not. I mean, I think my friendships created the structure in which for me to live after, you know, I had to move out of my home very quickly and try and piece my life back together. It was all built around and through relying on my friends. And so, that was just kind of the main thing that was structuring my life as I was writing. And so I think it comes out thematically on both sides.
And that aspect of friendship, I mean, is there less at stake in a friendship? It's seldom that we break up a friendship. Maybe people do. I'm just basing it. But, you know, you could often have a friend who you mightn't see or talk to for 10 years. It's not that you've fallen out with them, but then you meet them 10 years later and you pick up where you left off 10 years ago.
I think that's so beautiful. That's like the best kind of, that's the best kind of friend, because they've basically given you permission to continue to be who you are, and maybe that doesn't include them for a while. And there's something, we don't find that threatening, partially because we don't think of friends as like, they don't have the same kind of status, or you don't go through the same sort of rites that you do with romantic relationships or family relationships. But I think that they're, you know, my friends have outlasted any of my like romantic relationships. And in some ways there's a kind of romance to it eventually. You know, once I have friends that I don't get to see as often anymore because I live in Mexico City and a lot of my friends are still in the States, or my oldest friends are still in the States. But when I see them, it really does feel like I'm constructing this space with them that is still with me when I'm apart from them. And I find it to be very profound. So
finally, if I could, Catherine, the process of writing this book, I think you've spoken about crying in public, is there's a certain amount of that. That's what it is in some ways. But how cathartic a process was it to actually put down this, particularly the non-fiction side of things, and reflect it into the fictional side of the world? Did that sort things for you in any way?
I wouldn't say the writing exactly is catharsis. I would say that, you know, I think we get catharsis through our lives in one way or another, and the writing ends up being more of a side effect of it. I don't think it's like in the act of putting things down that I am transformed so much as life is transforming me. Life is transforming all of us, and the writing can kind of be a witness to that.
Thanks so much for speaking to us this evening, Catherine Lacey.
I appreciate it so much. Thanks for this conversation. It was a delight.
That's Catherine Lacey, and the book, The Mobius Book, is published by Granta. That is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Shannon Gorman. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.